Welcome to Coin Flips and Controversies, an OrthoBullets original series dedicated to exploring gray zone decisions in orthopedic surgery.
Welcome to Shoulder 360 Coin Flip. We are getting close to the annual course, third annual course coming around the corner. I'm so excited. I'm excited to see all of you at the course and continue to push the line on education, learning, and how we process and treat our patients better. So thank you all for being on the phone. We've got some major hitters. We've got Dr. Joaquin Sanchez Sotelo. We've got Adam Kahn on the West Coast and from the city of Brotherly Love. We've got the team of Abood and Williams, Abood being fellow of Williams. And so everything he says, Jerry, you are responsible for. The case I'm going to present is the following. I'll give you some simple history, some exams, and then I'm going to want you to sort of fire away. So this is a 58-year-old male, and I'm going to consider that a young male with left non-dominant shoulder pain. And this has been being medically treated for about a decade. It's really uncomfortable at this point in time. He's got difficulty sleeping at night. He's done therapy. He likes to be active. He's had injections. The injections have given him temporary relief. But at this point, he comes in and he's waving his white flag at me. He's like, "Doc, I've had it. I'm done." He's healthy. He doesn't have any major medical comorbidity. And he's got what I would call decent range of motion, 130 forward flexion, 70 of external. And he's not totally locked in internal. He's got good strength in his rotator cuff testing. So look, no reason to ask. All of us are going to get plain films, and here's his plain x-ray. Joe Abood, I'll show you an axillary, of course, in just a moment, and you can ask for a CAT scan and or MRI scan, but just tell me what insight you're getting from just looking at his x-ray.
I mean, his AP view, I would think he's got some medial erosion. I can't fully assess his retroversion and subluxation, obviously. At first glance, this seems to be a fairly straightforward shoulder.
Yeah, look, I think that's fair. One of the things I learned from Brad Parsons, who probably learned it from Jerry, is that when someone is medialized, I start to worry a little bit more about their posterior subluxation. I mean, look, you can have them without, they can be independent factors. But when they start to get medial, and when the greater tuberosity starts to get medial or flush with the lateral edge of the glenoid, I say to myself, there's some more deformity or something more there. Joaquin, any other thoughts just on just when you look at one x-ray? And I know that's inadequate to make any decision making.
Yeah, I think your point about looking at the lateral aspect of the greater tuberosity medial to the acromion almost, that's one. Then the other two is the glenoid neck is short. So you follow the so-called central end of the shoulder. You almost run very quickly into the end and fall into the face of the glenoid, and also the coracoid is slightly foreshortened. So those things are things that Dr. Caulfield used to point to me 20 years ago when looking at these x-rays.
So when you said a short glenoid neck, is the implication that this is a dysplastic glenoid or you're just saying it's medial?
Well, I think like in the hip and in other joints, there is a grade of dysplasia. There are patients that have minor dysplasia where the only thing you notice is that the neck is very medial, and when you plan reverse, in those cases, it's very easy to get abutment between the medial polyethylene and the neck. I couldn't tell you that this patient has a type C glenoid without looking at an axillary x-ray or a CT scan. I cannot tell.
Awesome. Now, just as an aside for everyone listening to the audience, Dr. Sanchez Sotelo suggested that, as he said, as in the hip and the knee. I hope we all know that Dr. Sanchez Sotelo first did a hip and knee fellowship at the Mayo Clinic prior to his stardom and escalation into the shoulder and elbow world. I hope I'm not sharing too many secrets. I won't share them all. I think some of them get out of line. So of course we have an axillary view. Adam, you want to add anything special on this axillary view?
Yeah, it's not a perfect axillary, but you know, I think based on what I'm seeing, it does look retroverted. I'd probably want to see a CT scan as well to just better assess that. Yeah. It does look like there's a loose body posteriorly as well.
Okay, someone suggested to me that there's still a joint space and that maybe I could avoid arthroplasty on this patient. How do you feel about that? This might be a scope debridement CAM type procedure because there's maybe a millimeter or two of joint space.
Yeah, I think, you know, that you can be fooled a little bit on that because sometimes with the osteophytes, I feel like you can falsely get a joint space here when they abduct their arm for the axillary view. But, you know, if you look at that AP, he did have loss of that joint space and kind of loss of all the cartilage there.
All right, Dr. Williams, I put the retroversion number in there for you, not measured by me, but by measured by a software program, 37 degrees. Can you classify, let's not get into what you do yet, just classify this glenoid?
Well, I think from my perspective, I didn't think the neck was as short as it could be. And for me, I usually see a little bit less in the way of erosion or erosive type characteristics in osteophytes and C glenoids. So this may be a B3. I think the important things for me are that the if you look at the humeral head with respect to the plane of the scapula, it's 100% posteriorly subluxed. But if you look at the humeral head in response or in comparison to the face of the glenoid, it's really not terrible. And I think if you look at the original AP view, I didn't think they were that medial. The greater tuberosity was even or slightly lateral to the acromion. And usually those are not some of the worst retroverted glenoids that I've seen.
Classify the glenoid.
For me, this is a B3.
Yeah, B3 as well. I think the osteophyte formation, but then also what Dr. Williams said about the neck, I don't feel like it was as short on the AP.
Not a huge osteophyte.
Yeah, I think it's a B3. And I like what Dr. Iannotti talks about, which is the convexity of the anterior wall, which you see with a C glenoid, which you don't see here. So that usually kind of helps me kind of classify more of a C, but this is a B3.
All right, B3, everyone's agreeing. Not significantly superior eroded. Jerry, can you tell me what is the significance of superior erosion and what is the proof for what you're going to tell me?
Well, I'll start with this, with the last question first. There's not a great deal of proof about what superior erosion does. If you're looking at it from the standpoint of placement of a reverse implant, superior tilt is bad. So if you had a superiorly tilted glenoid and didn't correct it and you were doing a reverse, there's a higher incidence of glenoid component loosening. Frankel has that article. There's also, I know that Angus Wallace was the first one to write about superior tilt of the glenoid in rheumatoid patients and actually talked about inferiorly tilting the anatomic glenoid. So there's not a great clinical amount of data to support it, but I think it makes logical sense. In an anatomic sense, it would make sense to have the component tilted inferiorly to give the rotator cuff a little bit of support. And then if you're going to do a reverse, it makes it less likely to get central component fixation failure.
All right. Let's go back to this. Adam, look, it's coming to surgery and it's coming to arthroplasty. So we don't need to sort of beat around the bush too much. What arthroplasty, if any, I guess, to you, are you going to offer this 58-year-old person with reasonable range of motion? And what are the factors based on what I've given you, what else you may need to help you make that decision?
Yeah, so, you know, I think, you know, you've given me a good amount of the factors. I think it's really a discussion with the patient. So I lay them all out. You know, I think for this, I would offer three different types, actually. So I would offer an anatomic with inset glenoid. And I think, you know, for B3 deformities, Dr. Ricchetti had good evidence that showed some central peg osteolysis with augmented components. And so I've kind of steered away from those in my practice with the bad retroversion and B3 deformities. So usually I'm trying to go for some type of inset glenoid to help get better fixation on that side. And I think the fact that he has preserved range of motion is one of the reasons that I would be shooting for an anatomic with this case. The other option I would give is basically a reverse with an augment. I think it's, you know, with this much retroversion, it's a little bit difficult to instrument a reverse if you try to match their native retroversion and kind of leave them where they are. And so I'd probably use some type of augmented off-the-shelf component to compensate for that. You could also use a bone graft as well, but I tend to use augments more than bone grafting. And then the last thing that's kind of, you know, caught my interest with these cases of hemiarthroplasty with pyrocarbon. which, you know, I haven't done a lot of cases like that, but I think for someone who's young, has good preserved motion, and is retroverted, you get worried about glenoid failure. And so, you know, offering them a hemiarthroplasty may be more, give them a little bit more longevity.
So Joaquin, this patient flies in to see you. They saw this Dr. Khan on the West Coast. He spent 90 minutes talking to the patient, really educated them. And the patient's like, he gave me three choices and I didn't even know which one he wanted to do. He got so confused. So he flies to see you and you've got him booked. He sees you on Monday. He's booked for Wednesday. What are you doing in the OR?
So for me, even though I love the way that Andy described all the options, these cases almost always today are reverse arthroplasty. One other observation is that if you look at the soft tissue shadows of the muscles, the subscap is a little bit thin in terms of the muscle belly compared to the infra. So that's one other thing that worries me. He's 58, so he's not ultra young. He's not ultra old either. But I think, you know, Dr. Iannotti has the best data, even trying to correct the joint line to as little as possible. And Jerry, correct me if I'm wrong, I think he had a higher failure rate in the B3 glenoids. From a different angle, Jill Walsh has talked about the same, that he never was able to get reliable long-term success of an old polyglenoid in a B3 glenoid. So for me, today, this is almost always a reverse.
Jerry, so Adam has given us three options. Joaquin has gone to reverse. How do you reconcile? I think you're responsible for training Adam. Is he right? Is he wrong? How does this shake out?
Well, I think Adam's description was great. I would like to make one point, though. Joe's article, Joe Iannotti's article on augments was for a stepped, half wedge component. And the reason why that resulted in medialization of the glenoid is because it requires that you ream the anterior half of the glenoid all the way to the center portion of the glenoid. And to do that in a glenoid like this takes away most of the glenoid and medializes it even further. So if you were going to use an augment for an anatomic implant in this case, it would be a full wedge anatomic augment where you don't take any bit of, take very little bone away and leave it in a little bit of retroversion and put it right where it lies. So I don't think it would be the same situation as what Joe said. Obviously, I've been known to do insect glenoids for this type of situation. Usually it's in somebody a little bit younger and with a little more bone. What worries me about this, Joaquin talked about it, but if you look at the anterior aspect of the scapula, that thing that looks like a, quote, loose body, there's that osteophyte that's attached to the glenoid, and then there's something a little anterior to that. It looks like a loose body. I will tell you that that is not a loose body. That is a calcification within the subscapularis muscle belly. That is old muscle. That is what used to be functional subscapularis. You can see the subscap is flat as a pancake. And that piece, if you go to take it out as a loose body, you'll wind up taking a third of the subscapularis muscle belly with you. So if it were not for that subscapularis finding, I would do an anatomic implant with a full wedge. But seeing that calcification in the subscap with pretty substantial, I mean, the atrophy of the subscapularis fatty replacement is dramatically different from the posterior muscles. So I think that subscap is shot. So this for me would be a reverse with an augment.
That's a huge nugget right there. And I don't mean literally, frankly, the nugget that you see in the anterior glenoid, but Jerry and Joaquin, pointing at that subtle finding that you should appreciate the soft tissue windows on the CT scan. And we all have the ability to change the windows or look at the windows differently. Joe, you and I finished a discussion on inset glenoids and version didn't matter. And Tony Miniacci just told you, Joe, that he does not need to correct it. Is Tony wrong? Can you say that online, on the internet?
Well, I think, yeah, Tony didn't have the benefit of seeing this case. And I think the nuance of this case may sway Tony in a different direction. But I think that if this was a B3 without the nuances of what Jerry just pointed out about the subscap, he may play where it lies with the glenoid the way he discussed it. Personally, I do not. And that's, I think, an issue with what I'm comfortable doing and what I'm familiar with. I don't use that type of glenoid. So for me to take on a challenging deformity like this with a glenoid I don't use often, I think is a disservice to the patient. So for me, this would be, depending on, again, the subscap integrity. If the subscap integrity was good, then potentially an augmented system that's an onlay. And if it's like this, then a reverse of some sort, depending on the system that I would want to use.
Gary, what's going to have the best range of motion? An inset, an inset primary arthroplasty, an augmented primary arthroplasty, or a reverse of some variety?
For this particular patient?
Or in general, for this type of deformity, absent this subtle finding or the important nugget of his subscapularis atrophy?
If you just look at the data. The range of motion for reverse, particularly rotational range of motion, will be the worst. But the reverse will probably last the longest. With regard to range of motion between inset and augmented, anatomic augmented, and it depends on the patient. So for this particular patient, if you look at the center of the surface of the glenoid and the center of the humeral head, it's not quite centered. Some of the B3s are almost concentric with regard to the surface. Those are the ones where I play it where it lies. This one is not quite centered, number one. Number two, I find that 40 degrees is about the limit of what you can handle well, putting it right where it lies. It's very difficult to get a straight shot at the glenoid when it's around 40 or more. So that's why I said if I were going to do an anatomic in this, I would do a full wedge augment because it would give me the opportunity of not having to ream perpendicular, quite perpendicular to the surface of the glenoid. But as I said, for me, the thing that pushed me over the edge on this particular case is the way the subscap is in the front. I'll tell you the way I learned that lesson is I had a patient that had two giant ones of those that I thought were loose bodies, and I wound up taking them all out. And by the time I got done, you could see through the subscapularis. So this is one that I would not attempt that in.
All right. So anyhow, let's just sort of move along because I want to get to some of the meat of the case here. I chose to put this in my planning software, and there's a number of different planning type softwares. And as I first put this in and said, look, let me see if I can do a simple play it where it lies type of primary implant, I got to about 32 degrees of retroversion. And for me, this is about 3 years ago, in fairness, I just wasn't comfortable enough with leaving something in that degree of retroversion. Even if I changed, as Andy Jawa will convince me, I can make an onlay, I can make this implant an inlay type implant if I ream it appropriately. And I just wasn't comfortable with this picture. Would anybody, just yes or no on the panel, or actually if anyone, yes, would anyone have tried this?
So you said, in fairness, are you saying 3 years ago you'd be more apt to an anatomic and now you're more apt to a reverse? What's fairness?
No, I mean, 3 years ago, I would have never even considered an anatomic.
You're saying now you're swaying more towards anatomic these days?
I still don't think I would do an anatomic in this case, but
I'm saying, you said in fairness, 3 years ago, you planned.
Oh, I'm saying in fairness, meaning the
push a little bit, because, you know, 360 is, you know, interactive and pushes. It's not kind of those typical academic meetings. So give me a reason why you said that.
I guess in the back of my mind, I would now consider inlay implants for C glenoids and for retroverted glenoids that are not so decentered. Yes, that's an absolute change for me that I did not consider 3 years ago. Adam, what do you think of that statement?
The other thing, Paul, I mean, I'm telling you, putting these where they lie is a challenge. You have to work at trying to get exposure to the glenoid to ream it appropriately without changing version. And honestly, it's a skill that you develop over a long time. And you get more comfortable with it. And you got to make sure you don't release the posterior capsule. There are a lot of things that you need to do to make this work.
So I continue to plan and play with the planning software, which is, again, I think that is a fundamental part of all of the work that I do. I have a hard time now without planning. Maybe it's become a crutch that I abuse. The next iteration I did is I planned a reverse with a full wedge. And I felt like I got reasonable contact, 62%. I felt like I had a reasonable correction. I got it to about 11 degrees from his 37. And I felt pretty happy about that. Joaquin, you're familiar with the software. how would you have planned this differently? This is 3 years ago, so this is before you could do any kind of custom or, you know, patient-specific implant.
I think your plan looks really good, Paul. One challenge is that these quote-unquote off-the-shelf augments do not allow you to correct fully deformity. So with this implant, this is probably the best you can do. The question is this acceptable? And I think that if you place this component this way, there is a high chance it will work, provided you get stability so that it doesn't dislocate. Yeah. One challenge, if you accept this consideration, is that you still are medial in terms of your sphere, so you have to use a lateralized sphere or a very thick polyethylene on the humeral side to avoid dislocation. But with this type of implant, this plan would be very good. I prefer to use screws myself as opposed to a post, but other than that, looks pretty good to me.
So as I went to look at what my range of motion, my impingement-free range of motion was with this apparatus, it became very clear that even after removing the osteophytes, I was still getting a lot of impingement because I was not able to adequately lateralize this patient. And Joaquin, you said that I could add a lateralized sphere. The challenge, at least with the software, not with real life, is that it doesn't allow me to combine a wedge and a lateralized sphere to get that extra few millimeters. So I was
That's a very important point, Paul. So if you look at your numbers there, see how in the center you have lateral 0 millimeters? So that means that you have taken the shoulder to where it was before your surgery, not premortis. So you're still medial. And to your point, it's not an FDA-approved application to place a lateralized glenosphere on an augmented base plate, but I do it all the time. It's a non-approved application, but you cannot plan it.
So I was very anxious. This is a young person, and I became very anxious that, look, I was really not getting the lateralization I felt that was going to be necessary with this type of implant, and I wasn't convinced that 3 millimeters more was going to be enough. Adam, what do you think about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're worried about impingement, you can try to, you know, sometimes I'll get a burr and I'll try to actually burr, you know, bone that's impinging, you know, both superiorly. You're worried more inferiorly, though. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Inferiorly, anteriorly.
Yeah. So, you know, the only other thing you could try to do is, you know, go to like a bone graft or something else so you could correct that version more, rather than just sticking with this current plan would be my other thought. But I think you would get more clearance with the lateralized sphere, to be honest.
When I went to try and figure out how to use a bone graft, and again, that's a little trickier with some of the software, but more advanced than other software programs, I needed 23 millimeters of bone on my maximal part of my wedge to get it work. Joaquin, what's the maximum amount of, I mean, I've never gotten more than 16 millimeters of bone when I try to do a bio-RSA, and I'm a fan of that operation. Can you get 20 millimeters of bone?
You can, if the patient is large enough. You have to basically go deeper than where the humeral neck is, and then use a small osteotom to pull it out. But I've never done that. I think in a patient like this today, I would prefer to do a patient-matched implant as opposed to an off-the-shelf wedge or a bio-RSA. But bio-RSA would be my number two. Maybe you accept an incomplete correction. You know, you don't have to go to 0 degrees of version, but maybe better than you are now.
So, Jerry, give me the final insight on the amount of retroversion that you consider acceptable, because it seems to be, depending upon the implant company that you associate yourself with, you either care more about getting closer to zero, or you just, if you're John Levy, you don't care at all what the retroversion is. Is there any insight on that?
Again, you know, you asked the question before about where's the data. There's not a whole lot of data, but I would tell you that if you were to ask most shoulder surgeons, a general number, I think for anatomics is less than 10, and the general number for reverses is 20. And it's not to say that I've never done more than 20. I hate bone grafts. I cannot stand them. I pretty much have given up on bone grafts unless I need like 3 inches of bone. And then I'll put a bone graft in and come back later and do an implant on the bone graft. They don't work for me. So what I would do in this case, before you put the sphere on, after you've got the glenoid sphere in, and I think that this position is perfectly fine. I think it's great. I like this position. What I would do before you put the sphere on is I would take a microsagittal saw and I would cut the anterior glenoid and the inferior glenoid even with the base plate. I would just remove it. And whether it's osteophyte or not, I would make sure there is no bone past the base plate.
And then Sorry.
Go ahead, Joaquin.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say, I would make sure that there's no bone projecting beyond the base plate, obviously, except superiorly. And I think if you did that, you wouldn't need a plus three sphere. But I, like Joaquin, have used the plus three sphere on numerous occasions. I have not found it to be a problem. I, like Joaquin, would also use a screw rather than a post.
I was going to mention, Paul, that something else that people talk about when you need a huge bone graft is to combine a bone graft and a wedge. So if you're in a hospital setting where you cannot do anything other than a wedge, let's say that, and you will need a massive bone graft, you can cut your augmentation in half and maybe do 50% with bone and 50% with metal. I think Lionel Nathan and Alex Diamond have published on that. So that's one other way to skin the cat, is combining bone graft with a wedge.
So, Paul, I think the best option for situations like that, where the bone loss is so bad that there's an augment, you can't find an augment that gets you even close, is a patient-specific 3D planted implant. I mean, if your mindset is, and to be, you know, when we started with all these augments, the concept behind the augments was, and it originally started with anatomics, but I feel just as strongly about reverses. The principle was to ream as little bone as possible, to make sure that you could get a component in with getting rid of as least amount more bone that you could. And if you take out the argument of cost and the time it takes to manufacture an implant, there's nothing better than not taking away any bone and putting an implant on the surface of the patient's bone, no matter how bad the defect. And if I got past, I think this is one that I could handle with an off-the-shelf implant and taking away from the bone from around the base plate. Much more than this, I think you need to do something more. And rather than adding a bone graft to anything, I would get a patient-specific 3D printed implant for this patient.
Well, Jerry, you know, you didn't let me in the fellowship. I had to go to the West Coast to get my shoulder training. talk about that. Maybe this isn't the forum, but I listened to you, and I was unrewarded with my manilateralization, and I thought I wanted to get a little bit more. So, let's just have fun for a second. Let's just see what the rest of the world thought of some of your questions. We don't need to go to all of them, but how did people classify this? This was actually a C glenoid, then more so than a B3.
Can you go back? You had one shot of the MRI, because I think that's another good thing that I look for in C glenoids, but I usually look for like a hyperplastic labrum, and I don't think I saw one in this case. And for me, that's, you know, another kind of sign you can look at and kind of decide.
So I, again, good point. But Adam, are you aware, or Jerry or Joaquin, the inter and the intra rate of reliability of the Walsh classification? Does anyone know? Can anyone give me that?
It's got to be pretty low, I think.
It's been looked at before. I think something, for some reason, 30% comes to my mind, but I can't remember why. That's been looked at, and it's not reproducible.
It also depends if you have expert versus all comers, and also if you have x-rays or CT scan. You know, that completely changes the reliability.
All fair. So now we just look at those individuals who chose to do shoulder replacement, anatomic replacement. Only a quarter said they would not. And of those people who said they would do replacement, some would just do a standard. 16% of those responders out of 150, most would augment it. There's just a small portion in layers. A couple metal backs. Maybe those are European people, Joaquin?
Could be.
But really,
so Paul, if this was a patient that was much younger, like maybe 38 instead of 58, and it had the same looking glenoid, you might think about doing, this is one of the few cases I would do a bone graft with a metal back glenoid. But the key there is it can't be so big. The central boss of the metal backed implant, no matter whose you use, has to go through the graft into the native glenoid. And if that's not in the native glenoid where you can get ingrowth, it will fail. But that might be what some of the metal back people were thinking about.
I mean, that's amazing that they're still all over the place, right? If you chose to reverse, would you use a CT? I think the majority here, 65%, are using a CT to help guide us along. if we chose a reverse, would use patient-specific guides and implants. So if you did reverse, let's see what the survey says here. Standard guides, standard implants, 25%. Patient-specific guides, standard implants, 38%. Custom implant, 20%. So a lot of people would use a guide to get them with a standard implant.
So Paul, the thing with that is, if you're going to take it off the shelf and use the full wedge implant, there's only so much you can make up. And this patient has more deformity than could be made up completely with an augment. So I think you would just use the guide and put it where you think the regular guide. But if you were going to use a patient-specific implant, by definition, you have to use a PSI.
Joaquin, any comments on these findings? And all of you, Adam and Joe, I mean, I'm ripping through these, not because I want to go too fast, but I think it's fascinating to see the lack of consensus. And you're 100% right. This is a general audience, but really that's the real world. There's the people who would not engage chose not to answer. So Joaquin, any insight on or statements about these findings?
So I think in the spectrum of shoulders you can tackle with arthroplasty, this falls into the category of difficult. I think this is difficult to do technically. So for me, I think if you want to really help your patient, you should do everything possible to get this right. So even if you choose to use an off-the-shelf augment, in this case, I'm using a PSI. Even though for me, like for Dr. Williams, I would prefer to use a patient-matched implant for the reasons we mentioned, that an off-the-shelf will not give you a complete correction in this patient.
And the world seems to agree with you. 58% would use some sort of guide. With or without a specific implant. But yeah, Adam, would you have gotten a guide for this case?
I probably would have gotten a guide for this. And I think one thing we didn't truly touch on yet was like an alternate center line. And I think that's another option for this. I think all the reason there are so many options is because, again, you can do this case with a couple different ways. And it's good as a shoulder surgeon to have those different tools in your toolkit. So, you know, I don't think you're always going to know every single part of the case that's going to happen. So having kind of plan A, B, and C when you go in. But I think, you know, an alternate center line with a bone graft behind it would be another option to add to kind of the list of things we talked about already.
So I think you're exactly right. And I guess here's my question that's specific to that. When you use a monoblock alternate center line and you choose that degree of retroversion, you have to have a fixed amount of that base plate against the native glenoid. You can't really have it sit off or be you're very limited on the degree of lateralization. So for me, the super challenge in this case is even if I put in a wedge, I still wasn't getting adequate lateralization. So how do they make up for that with an all-center line in this case?
Yeah, so for me, I mean, you want, you know, ideally 50% coverage. You may not get to that with the alternate center line, but basically you're using your bone graft behind it to support it. And that's why pre-op planning and a PSI guide help in this case. So I would, you know, plan it so that I get the exact size of my bone graft and try to get, you know, 40 to 50% coverage on that native anterior glenoid, and then get a PSI guide so I could hit it exactly where I'd planned it.
Jerry, if you were compelled to do an alt center line, do you feel like you could get away with it in this case and get it appropriately lateralized?
You mean without an augment, just with a monoblock base plate?
Yeah, with a monoblock, and let's say you're allowed to put a bone graft underneath that just so that you get coverage. It's just, you're not getting native coverage without taking down a lot of anterior glenoid, really medialized.
No, my answer to that would be, and I'm just going to speak for myself, I don't think I could. The two uses for me for the alternate center line, by far the best one, is a cavitary defect and a revision. And I actually will often do that with an augmented base plate. I'll use the Stryker base plate and put it, if you're truly in the alternate center line, you're not in the scapular spine. You're actually at the junction of the scapular spine, the glenoid and the coracoid. And there's a wafer of bone there that if you get right in the alternate center line, you actually won't even be bicortical. You'll be unicortical for a very long ways if you're in it correctly.
Without a guide, can you predictably find the alt center line?
It's hard. I mean, you got to do it a lot of times. And if you're doing it in a revision, you can't get a guide, really, unless you do a cement spacer first and get a CT scan that way. And even then, you know, most of the companies won't, they'll tell you that the CT scan is not accurate enough to get a guide. So I think that my use for alternate center line in a primary case is not very common. And so it's not going to be that often where I could get a guide that would put me in the alternate center line every time.
when Mark Frankel watches this, he's going to have one or two strokes. I just want to warn you and caution you that, you know.
That's all right. Mark and I argue a lot.
Your phone will ring. Just looking at what the world, what 137 people thought their acceptable version is, the majority, 30, 62 plus 9, 71% want to stay under 20 degrees, Jerry, as you've suggested, and the rest of them are outliers. So under 20, Joaquin, is that an acceptable number to spread to the world, under 20?
Yeah, I think I prefer to go under 15 actually myself, but I think if you have to push it to 20, it's okay. Beyond that, I think it's too much.
Adam, so I have 20 from Williams, 15 from Sanchez Sotelo. What do I have from you?
I'd say 20 is kind of a general rule, but again, I think every case is going to be a little bit different because, you know, you're not, you know, every patient, their scapular motion is different. They're, what you're seeing on the humeral side is different. So I don't think there's a true exact number, but generally 20 degrees would be what I'm sticking at.
Abood, what's your number of retroversion?
I'm going to correct him as much as I can. I don't think I have an absolute number. I think the reverse is much more forgiving in an anatomic. So for me, as long as I get good support of my base plate and good lateralization.
What does that mean? What does that mean, good support of your base plate? Like you rock it really hard, it doesn't come out. At 6 weeks, you don't see lysis. What does that mean?
Depending on the base plate you use, I mean, for me, it's 50, 60% coverage. If I get that kind of coverage and, peripheral screw fixation that I'm happy with, then that's a good bite. I don't think, you know, again, it's a sphere. So I think you're in a reverse situation, you're rotating on a sphere. I think you could be somewhat retroverted or antiverted and it's not a huge deal. They'll still get pretty good range of motion. So yeah. I think if it's 15, 20 degrees, I'm not so much of a purist.
Let's see what I got here. All right, here's the next poll question. The question was, if you chose a reverse, how would you manage the glenoid? So a couple of people didn't want to do a reverse. One person or two people want to leave the version. There's 6% wanted to eccentric. There was 6% bone grafters, Jerry, that people are listening to. They're not hearing Dr. Boileau that bone grafts work. The majority are going to do an augmented base plate. Again, a bio-RSA, not so popular, some kind of combo. Really, the majority coming in here are going to do some sort of augmented base plate, which is pretty much our consensus. How would you implant it? Now, I think this is more the question we were looking for. What are you going to do here? And again, the majority, we have 11% bone grafting on this one, but 59% with a posterior augment. So Adam, fewer people for alternate center line, 8%. What would you really do, Adam?
Yeah, so I think I would really do a probably full wedge augment and probably lateralize on the sphere based on your plan and kind of what I'm seeing. So that's kind of what I would do in real life. But I was just presenting that as another option.
Yeah. So I'm going to skip these ones about management of the subscap. Not that they're not interesting, but they're interesting. Would you repair the subscap, Joaquin?
If I can, yes.
Jerry?
Same. If it's repairable, I would repair it. If it's not, I wouldn't.
Yeah. So I subsequently went on to design, or I didn't design, I requested the engineers at another company design a custom implant that one would maybe potentially give me greater degree of lateralization and greater degree of a posterior buildup. This is, again, a couple of years ago. So there's some subtle learning points that I've subsequently had. But here's the implant that I put in 3 years ago. Joe, 360, tough love. What do you think of this implant? What do you think of the ultimate position? Because I'll be honest, I think I would do it slightly differently today. And what do you think the result will be?
Well, I mean, I think that I've used this implant. I've liked this implant. I've used it for, I think, more severe deformities in my hand. I know I was in the minority of the respondents, but I have used the alt center line with some bone grafting in the back and not necessarily corrected them back to, 10 degrees of retroversion. So I don't think I would have used it in this case, but I think this is a good choice. I think your reconstruction here is by all accounts good. I think your lateralization is reasonable. You got a good deltoid wrap. You probably distalized probably adequately, maybe a little over distalized, but it's a male, probably good bone quality. I'm not as concerned about acromial stress fracture. These are hard to reduce given the amount of lateralization you have on the base plate and the glenosphere. So technically I do these a little differently as far as I put the base plate in, then I put the stem and the liner in, and then I put the glenosphere and then I reduce them. So, but that's the technical aspect of the procedure, but this looks good.
So you raise all good points. I think that this is aggressively lateralized. And that's probably the early engineering parts of me learning how to use this and communicating with the engineers that I want less lateralization. But I really am unrewarded, you know, and if I'm critical looking at this, I think it's over distalized, you know, in hindsight. I don't know, actually, I do know now how I could have beaten that, but I think I can ask the engineers to make it not so distal, or I can use an eccentric sphere and turn it up the opposite way. But that's the first observation. Adam, you know, again, you're not going to hurt me because we're all learning, and this is a couple years ago, and I think I do better now, but what are your comments?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what's been said. I think the only comment I would say is, it does, on first look, it does look a little bit over distalized, but the reconstruction is great. You got good contact on the base plate on the backside. It looks like it kind of keyed in there nicely. I've only done two of these kind of custom implants, and I've been really impressed and surprised with their range of motion. So I anticipate this guy's going to have really good motion after this.
Joaquin, comments?
I think it looks really good. If you want to be hypercritical, which I think is a minor thing, maybe it's slightly too inferiorly tilted because the central screw is aiming up in reference to the fossa line of the supra, maybe a little bit, and maybe over-distalized as well. But the challenge I have found with this type of construct is that I don't know where the lateral aspect of the sphere should be, because you cannot really modify this. You're going to place it as they give it to you, right, in the OR, and then you're stuck because you don't have many options to change your lateralization more medial. So if I was going to plan this, I would go slightly more medial on the metallic augment so that I can play with a more lateralized sphere if I have to.
I mean, I
lateralize from the metal, because then you cannot go any more medial because you're using the thinnest possible sphere. So that's the only thing I would do, maybe make it a little narrower. And if intra-op I'm loose, I always can use a plus three or a plus six in the biomass system.
I completely agree with every statement that you made. And we haven't commented yet that I mixed and matched the sphere and the humeral implant. This is not the traditional onlay implant that's associated with this glenoid component. And that's because that's an onlay implant, which would have further lateralized and further distalized me. So I have to use a 36 because 36 is the only one that will translate to other religions. And I mixed and matched. Jerry, what do you think of that? And give me your overall thoughts on this. Again, this is good learning. The 19 now, but this is number two.
Match situation, I've probably done it 150 times, not with this particular implant, but I like an inlay humerus. Up until this point in time, the companies whose humerus I use doesn't have an augmented base plate. So I can't tell you how many times I've missed and matched. I've lost track. So it's an off-label use. You have to tell your patient that, but as long as it's the same size, I don't have a problem with it. The other two things I'd like to clear up is I'm a big fan of the alternate center line. I just wasn't for this particular case. And Mark's side, you know, this is another concept of Frankel. You know, when he first came up with the idea, people thought he was crazy. And if you ever use the alternate center line, you'll hit it one time and you'll be a firm believer. The second issue is if you were to ignore everything medial to your humerus and just take your humerus straight superiorly so that the greater tuberosity was even with the top of the glenoid, that's exactly where an anatomic humerus should be. It's not lateralized at all. That's exactly the spot where it would be. It's just too distal. And now, Frankel's now his big thing. He's been, I say now, he mentioned this concept 10 years ago, the anatomic reverse. Again, people thought he was crazy. What did he mean by that? What he meant by that is in a situation where there's not a massive cuff tear and you have muscles that need to be at the right length, it makes sense to try to get the humerus in the same position with respect to the glenoid as it would have been if it were anatomic. So what does that mean? you put the implant on the glenoid side higher with more lateralization. So I think in this particular case, if you would just raise this implant, I don't know, centimeter and a half, 2 centimeters, it would be an anatomic reverse, which would be perfect. So I agree with Joaquin. Under these circumstances, what I would have done is try to make a little less of the defect up on the base plate side and use the glenoid sphere, because you have more options to pick your lateralization. But I think in terms of the implant, I think it's perfectly seated. It's, I mean, this is why patient-specific implants are eventually going to be much more common.
All right. Well, last one. Here's his range of motion afterwards.
Both arms up overhead. Bring them down by your side. Can you rotate your hands out to the side for me? Great. Now, if you turn around, let's see what you can do. Turn your whole body around for me. Let's see what you're behind your back now. If you reach behind your back, perfect.
So I think I got away, you know, and of course I'm going to show a case with decent motion, and I have ones without as good, but I think I probably got away with his distalization because he's a pretty big dude. I worry that if I did this in a smaller person or a female, I would have the acromion slowly tilting down and causing me misery. I'd love in the last 3 minutes to go down the panel and just, you know, final words of insight, Joaquin, Adam, Joe, then Jerry, in that order. So Joaquin, you're up.
Number one, congratulations. This is a very difficult case and the motion is outstanding, you know, so I think we've covered most of it. One final thing I was going to mention is that the rate of ingrowth of these components is very different in the primary shoulder and the revision setting. So custom prosthesis, we have had failures at Mayo Clinic in the revision setting, because sometimes if there is osteolysis, you may think you get primary sterility, but you don't get ingrowth. So using this in primary is very, very, very reliable, I think.
Good point. And, you know, implicit, but that is, when we looked up our 19 implants, 70% of them were primary. And I was surprised by that. I assumed it was going to be, these custom implants were going to be more for revision. And when I compare it to a few other series out there, similarly, a lot of people will use them in primaries. Adam, final thoughts.
Yeah, thanks, Paul, for having me. It's been a great panel. Really interesting case. I think there's a lot of value in, you know, learning these different options, because, you know, not every case is going to be the same. And so for me, it's nice to kind of go through these. And again, I think, you know, like you said, a lot of people are leaning towards reverse. And I think in this case, it made a lot of sense. But there's still a role for anatomic replacement and even hemiarthroplasty for some of these patients, and they can see good benefit from them.
No doubt. Really good comments. Joe, final.
Yeah, the outcome is fantastic. I'm not sure who the surgeon speaking to the patient was, but it clearly wasn't you, because they
more feminine voice.
But that person got a good outcome in that patient.
Good.
One other comment, Paul, is that this will probably last longer than an anatomic.
No question.
Now you have ingrowth and motion.
No question.
Patient probably enjoy this for 20 years easily.
Joaquin, this is going to wear like a hip.
Yep, that's exactly right.
The amount of volume
and vitamin E poly is going to last for a long time. So this patient was really helped with this operation. Congratulations again.
You know, the fact of the matter is, Paul, if you could get a predictable functional outcome like this in every reverse and have no stress fractures, anatomics would go away. And yeah. So the bottom line is, I don't know how patients get this kind of external or internal rotation. His external rotation wasn't quite as good as his internal rotation. I wonder whether that's related. But the bottom line is, I've noticed in my patients that do get good internal rotation, if I wind up doing their other side, they get the same thing. And I don't know what the anatomic characteristic is, but I think there's something about the patient's anatomy and perhaps lateralization that gets internal rotation. I mean, that's an outstanding result. And, you know, I mean, as I said, you know, if you could figure out a way to make early polyethylene failure go away with anatomics, and stress fractures and poor motion and internal rotation go away with reverses, it'd be hard to figure out which one to do.
Yep.
You know, it would be difficult.
All right. Well, I appreciate all of your time and all your comments. I still think this is a journey and continue to grow and learn. And I appreciate that you took time out of your night. 360, that's the course. That's where we learn these things. That's where we press the envelope. Looking forward to seeing you all there. Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, Paul.